Hello and welcome to today's edition of Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Duke. Today in the question is slot, I'll be asking Barry Smith. He's Professor of Computer Science at UCD and founder of UCD's spin-out company, Haystacks, whether it's possible to improve our internet searches to make them quicker and more efficient through cooperation rather than searching on our own. In the writer's room, I'll be talking to Niall McCotter. He's the author of Ireland's Animals, Myths, Legends and Folklore. And in What's It All About, we'll be discussing prime numbers, what they are, and why they're important to all of us with Professor Des McHale. He's a mathematician based at University College Cork. But first of all, today I'm delighted to welcome into the studio Barry Smith. As I said, he's Professor of Computer Science at UCD and he's founder of a company called Haystacks, which is based out on the campus at UCD, Nova UCD. And I think he's going to tell me now, but the main aim of Haystacks is to improve how we all search on the internet. So welcome to the show, Barry.
Thanks very much, Sean. Nice to be here.
No problem at all. Now, really, I suppose when we think of internet searching, there's an awful lot that's happened on the internet, but really it's pretty much stayed the same for the last number of years that we go in, and now Google is very dominant. So, you know, you can put something into the internet and you just hope for the best that it's going to produce the results that you want. But, you know, you're looking at doing it a different way that might be better for all of us.
Yeah, you're right. Search has stayed relatively stable over the last 10 years or so, but the main search engines like Google do a very good job in the main of responding to our searches. But at the same time, very often when we type a query into Google or Yahoo or Bing, we don't find what we're looking for. One of the problems there is that users themselves aren't very good searchers. We often use very vague terms for our queries, for example. Another problem is that we search on our own. You know, we're left to our own devices. We have to figure out what queries to use and what results to select. And we believe that by collaborating with our friends and colleagues as we search, we can get better results back from Google, Yahoo and Bing.
Sure, it makes perfect sense because, of course, we're all cooperating online now anyway with our, you know, Facebook, things like that. So why not apply it to the searching?
That's right. And the evidence suggests that very often when we're looking for something, maybe 2 out of 3 of the times we're looking for something, one of our friends has already found that very thing. Mm-hmm. And yet Google doesn't take advantage of that. So let's make Google more social. That's what we decided to do with Haystacks.
Okay. So Haystacks, I mean, you mentioned here that Haystacks really, you found that the way we search and the type of searches we do are, you know, as you mentioned, inefficient sometimes or we're not precise enough. If we get a stack together now, this concept of a stack, maybe you can give us a few examples, maybe in education or our social lives. How would it work?
Sure. Well, maybe the simplest way to think about a stack is kind of like a folder. When you start a new project, you'll often create a folder on your computer and you use it to organize your various files. When you search, you can create a search stack. And let's imagine that you're planning a vacation with some friends. And you may create a stack and call it My Summer Holidays. And you can share that stack with the friends that you're going on holidays with through Haystacks.
Sure, sure. So let's say skiing holiday. So, you know, you're all keen skiers and you want to know about the best chalets and where the snow is good or the slopes or whatever. So the idea is to rule out information that isn't good, really, by cooperating.
That's right. That's right. As you or your friends search for places to go, cheap ski gear, ski passes, Haystacks puts that information that you think is relevant into your skiing stack. And now when your friends go and search for similar topics, they'll see the results that you found relevant, recommended to them right there as they're using Google or Bing, and you'll see results that they found relevant right there, recommended to you as you're using Google or Bing.
Sure, so you're not wasting your time. And obviously for business, this is highly relevant because I think you mentioned to me before that an awful lot of searches just fail or you get the wrong thing or you spend a lot of time doing things really that are getting you nowhere. So if you can make it more efficient, then business are going to be listening to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And search is a massive advertising industry because so many companies need to make sure that their content gets to the top of the search rankings. It's becoming increasingly difficult because people are starting to manipulate rankings as well. So we need extra help from our friends. We can no longer just trust the search engine rankings to give us the best results that are available.
So Haystacks, you know, this is going to be a trust thing, really, that you're going to produce something that people can really trust because they're cooperating with each other to decide what is of good quality and what is maybe of less good quality.
That's right. You trust what your friends like. You decide who you collaborate with. You can decide which of your searches are private versus which of your searches you might like to share.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now Haystacks, it's just been founded. You've just gone online. Is that it recently? So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the business model and how you might actually make money out of this great idea.
Sure. Well, it goes back to some research that was carried out over the last few years in University College Dublin. Myself and my co-founders, Maurice Coyle and Peter Briggs, realised that there was a good potential opportunity for Haystacks in the commercial world. And so we set up a startup. We've got together with Jonathan Dillon, who's our new CEO based out of San Francisco, who's an ex-VP of Yahoo over in the States, an Irish guy who headed over to San Francisco many years ago. And now we've got the company set up, we're up and running, we raised VC funding, and now we're looking to release Haystacks to the world. So as of last week, Haystacks is now open for people to join.
Okay, so haystacks.com or .ie?
Haystacks.com, and it's an unusual spelling. It's HEYSTAKS.com.
Okay. And is the model based on people subscribing, or, you know, have you? What's the revenue stream ultimately?
Ah, yes. Well, it's
an important question.
As with many social enterprises these days, it's completely free for users to use. So okay. You download the Haystacks plugin for your Firefox browser or for your iPhone or your iPad.
Okay.
And we're now focused on getting users. We're not focused on making money from those users in by asking them to subscribe or by charging them. The Haystacks business model will evolve over the coming months to start to look at a number of revenue
opportunities. Right, and I presume the quality will be as good as the people that are actually using it then.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks very much. We've just run out of time, but thanks very much for coming in and telling us all about that new way of searching on the internet, Haystacks. It's an Irish company based in UCD, and we're just talking to one of its founders. Thanks, Barry, for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Now, this week, looking through some science news, it appears that loneliness can be actually hazardous to your health. We know, of course, that loneliness is not something that's very pleasant, but scientists have looked at this in detail, and it appears that loneliness can be as bad as smoking when it comes to increasing your risk of death, and it's worse even than physical inactivity or obesity. And apparently what it does, this was a study done in Chicago, is that it leads to unhealthy changes in your cardiovascular system, that's your heart, your immune system, and your nervous system. It leaves you in a state of openness to any kind of infection that comes along. And interestingly, loneliness may not be that you have very few social contacts. People can be lonely and have many social contacts. So it's loneliness in terms of the mind of the person that experiences it that's important. And also, if you feel that you would like to help somebody that may be lonely, that lives nearby, it seems that if people feel that they're being helped, or if they're, it's only being done on sufferance, that this really doesn't work too well because it reduces the self-esteem even further. And also, people that are lonely, according to this paper in Science that was produced in Science, which is the magazine of the American Association of Scientists, very prestigious, it also interferes with sleep patterns. So certainly loneliness is something to be avoided at all costs. And for those of us that are lucky enough to have lots of family and friends around us, then certainly this is going to increase our quality of life. And now it seems it's going to give us a longer life too. Okay, so now we're going to move on. And I'm delighted now to have a guest on the line. His name is Niall McArthur. He's the author of Ireland's Animals, Myths, Legends and Folklore, which is a beautiful book that's been produced by the Collins Press. It takes a different look at Ireland's animals in terms of, you know, how Irish people, maybe an early Christian or even before that, used to look and categorise at our animals. So welcome to the programme, Niall.
Hello, Sean. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So this isn't your first book. It's now your third book, but it's certainly a beautiful book. And I'm holding it here in my hand now at the moment, and it looks gorgeous anyway. So obviously, before we talk about the content, the writing in the book, the illustrations are beautiful. So obviously, that was something that was important to you.
Oh, it was, definitely. It really helps for people to get a feel for each animal if you have good illustrations, you know.
Yeah.
So fortunately, we got Gordon Darcy, and we're very, very happy with the illustrations. I think they're fantastic.
Okay, this isn't Gordon Darcy, the rugby player, of course.
No, this is he's an illustrator. He lives in the west of Ireland.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Gordon Darcy, yeah.
Yeah, so you mentioned that actually you're a Dubliner. You came from a bilingual background, so it's clear that you've a great interest in Irish history and Irish culture, and you know how we looked and categorised our animals before the Anglo-Normans came in.
Well, yes, I mean folklore carries on even after the Anglo-Normans. So, I mean, I suppose there's two main strands. The mythology aspect would be sort of Gaelic mythology, but the folklore end of it is kind of carried on up into the present day, you know. People had pishogues and beliefs about animals right up to modern times, really. So,
absolutely. So, I mean, if you look at the ancient view of animals, we have these ideas in our mind about certain animals that they have certain characteristics. Like we think of a fox as being sly and a donkey as stubborn, and they're very much embedded in our minds. I mean, did the Irish a long time ago think in the same way about animals?
I think they did, yes. Yeah, I think there was a general idea across Europe looking at animals in the same way, kind of built up over the centuries, I suppose. Like dogs are the faithful companion, and cats are sort of very independent and aloof. I mean, a small amount of it is based on a real observation of the animal, and then people sort of put human characteristics
on top of that. Yeah. And you go through, a chapter is devoted to each animal, like the horse, deer, wolf, fox, etc. And then you categorise them into four main categories, which I thought was interesting, which is totally different to what, say, modern zoologists would do. You've got fiery, I'll just read the four, fiery, airy, earthy, and water. So what's that based on?
Well, it's just really based on people's perceptions of animals. I'm not claiming there's any scientific basis to it at all. So it's just about, well, fiery animals would be more sort of animals that are perceived to be sort of proud and noble. And also, so you have got the horse and the stag and so on. But you've also got animals who are sort of fierce in there, like the wolf and the stoat, even though it's small, people saw it as very fierce. And then earthy animals are sort of loyal, dependable, stolid kind of animals, and we have we put our characteristics on them, that they're sort of faithful and so forth.
Sure.
And, you know, and airy animals then would be sort of intelligent, crafty, thinking, but also animals, I mean, some of it is sort of like bats I put in there, and bees as well, because they do actually fly, you know. And then water animals are seen as kind of mysterious and otherworldly, because they're out there in the ocean or the river, and you see them sometimes and they disappear and so on. So it's just to have a different way of looking at animals, a kind of a fresh...
Sure, yeah, it is, absolutely. And you realise, like, I didn't really realise that several place names in Ireland are based on animals, or the Irish version of the animal.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Maybe give us a few examples there, if you can think of any, around the country.
Well, I suppose a lot of them would be... the horse appears in a lot of names. You put me on the spot now, but sort of couple would appear in a lot of names, and I think Ockram is something to do with a horse, and Ach as well is a steed, the old word for a steed. And there's Clontarf, where I come from, is the meadow of the bull as well. And
what's that in Irish then, the meadow?
Clún Tarrf.
Right, Clún is meadow and Tarrf is bull. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
So, I think they're mainly it's mainly deer or cattle or, the Boyne comes from the goddess Bovindus, the white cow, who is seen as like the Boyne was sort of like her milk flowing across the land and the fertility and so on. So I mean, it goes back a long way. The idea of the landscaping attached to animals, you know?
Sure. And I mean, your book is also, it's very much about myths and legends and folklore, of course, to do with animals. And, you know, I mean, the one that I remember, of course, from school is Cú Chulainn. And, but there's lots more like that, isn't there?
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, as well as Cú Chulainn, Finn McCool had his own trusty hound called Bran. And there was various stories of Bran saving Fionn's life and stuff like that and fighting alongside him, you know, to defeat enemies. I mean, I think the hounds, it gives a picture of sort of earlier warrior society in Ireland where the hound was nearly like one of the warriors and the relationship between man and hound was sort of like a friendship. It was more than just a work animal or a pet. It was kind
sure.
of a,
because in modern society, of course, we've got our pets and we've got our work animals, but maybe there was a different relationship going back to Breton or back to early Christian times in Ireland.
Yeah, I think so. I think animals were seen as more kind of having their own spirit, if you like, rather than just utility. Or I think we tend to kind of have a slightly schizophrenic attitude to animals nowadays. They're either sort of beloved, cuddly pets, or they're terrible vermin,
yeah.
Or they're just kind of, you know, domestic animals like cattle or something, you know, that's sort of out there in the fields. But I think they had a more rounded picture of what animals were like back then, because they lived beside them, you know, they saw all their aspects, you know.
Absolutely, and it's very much, I mean, for anyone interested in animals or nature, or of course, it's very, very much of interest, and it's an Irish book as well, and it's a beautifully illustrated book, and it's
yes,
a great read. So I'd recommend it, and it's... the price at the moment is, what is it? It's $27.95 I got it for, which is available now in hardback, and certainly I'd recommend it. So what's next, Niall, after this?
What's your next project? I'm just taking it easy at the moment, but I'll be thinking of something, I'm sure, in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming on today and telling us about your book. That's Niall McArthur. He's the author of Ireland's Animals, Myths, Legends and Folklore. Okay, now we're going to talk about prime numbers, which some of us may or may not remember from school. These numbers apparently are very important for many things. And on the line to tell us about that, I'm going to be talking to Professor Des McHale. He's a mathematician at UCC. He was talking about prime numbers as part of a series of lectures to try and promote science and mathematics to the public, to show how science is relevant to the public. And this is part of a series that's going on in University College Cork. Welcome to the programme, Professor.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks very much. Maybe tell us just a little bit about the UCC lecture series then. Is the idea to try and reach out to the public and to explain science in a way that makes it more relevant?
Well, that's exactly it. We've had a wonderful programme and there's still a lot to go. I mean, the first one was on bacteria, human migrations. My own was on the prime numbers. And then there are other ones on AIDS and making computers from pencil lead and DNA and, all sorts of interesting topics, but they're put together in such a way that the general public will understand them. Now, that's a difficult brief because it means you've got to come down off your high horse and start at the very beginning. But I was very lucky because I gave one last week and I had an audience of about 100 people from all over Cork, I would think, and fantastic response. You know, I mean, you can always tell if an audience is good because A, they're awake for a start, and B, they're sort of, they're really taking part, and then the questions afterwards were very enlightening as well. So I enjoyed it. And the thing is that giving an lecture like that, you learn as much from giving it as you do from attending it.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great idea, and I'd like to see it in other parts of the country as well. But
yeah, well, Professor Willie Revel now is the person who works, the organizer.
From the Irish
Times. And
then
Times, all of the lectures go online afterwards, which is interesting. So people can look at them in any part of the world, which I think is good.
Brilliant. So tell us about prime numbers now. First of all, we should define, what is a prime number?
Well, this is my final year in the department. I'll be retiring in a couple of times.
Oh, okay.
So I thought I'd like to do something mathematical, just to show that mathematics can be done at this level.
Sure.
And I picked the prime numbers because they're the very basic building blocks of mathematics, and everyone knows the prime numbers 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13. They're basically the numbers that have no factors except themselves and 1. So you can't break them down any further.
Divisible by themselves and 1.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a good question to ask is, when is a given number prime or not? And I do it geometrically. I draw diagrams. And if you can make a rectangle, for 12, you can make a rectangle 3 by 4 or 6 by 2. But for 13, the only rectangle you can make is just 13 by 1 or 1 by 13, which is the same thing. So geometrically, they can be made into rectangles or squares or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's the geometric picture. But it's a very difficult question now. If I write down a number there on the table and it's 200 digits long, to ask you, can you tell if that's a prime number or not? And that's a very difficult problem that's been around for a long time. And of course, nowadays we can use computers to actually discover what factors are, because we can look at them very, very quickly. But there was a time when this all had to be done by hand, by pencil, but people still actually worked out. They spent years and years and years showing that certain numbers were prime.
And why would it be important to know if a very large number is a prime or not?
Well, I mean, first of all, mathematically, every number can be written as the product of primes in one and only one way. So they're the basic building blocks of mathematics, of numbers. Every number can be broken down into its prime factors.
Okay, however, so everything else is built upon a prime number.
They're the building blocks of mathematics.
The most fundamental
numbers. That's absolutely it. Prime means primus, the first. They're the first numbers you think of.
Okay.
I mean, this is just maybe of theoretical mathematical interest. But about 20, 30 years ago, it was discovered that very large prime numbers could be used to make secret codes that could not be broken.
Okay, now this brings us maybe back to World War II, would it?
That's right. Yeah. Well, no, it's after that, because after in World War II you had codes of a different kind.
Okay.
And it was only about the 1980s that people discovered that there were ways of actually encoding. For example, suppose I ask you what 6 multiplied by 7 is. It's 42.
42, yeah.
Right? And that's an easy question. But suppose I asked you what's the factors of 91?
Yeah.
You might have to stop and think. First of all, is 91 a prime number, or is it a factors? And it turns out that it's got factors 7 by 13, but most people don't learn the 13 times table, so they wouldn't actually know that.
Yes,
right?
doesn't trip off the tongue.
The problem of actually factoring a number into its prime factors is a very difficult one.
Okay.
Now, suppose I have one very big prime number, maybe 100 digits long, and you have another big prime number, another 100 long, and we multiply them together, and we get a great big long number, a colossal number. Now, you and I know what its factors are because we know the numbers that went into it, but nobody else would actually be able to find those factors, even with a very fast computer, in less than, let's say, a month.
Right,
and
so this is the basis of encryption.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can use this fact to send secret codes from one to the other that nobody can decipher unless they can factor the numbers. And, you know, even the fastest computers cannot do numbers, let's say, 1,000 digits long, factorize them in less than a month. So in that period of time, the information that we've sent to each other via those numbers is actually secret. Although they're working harder and harder and harder to actually break this type of code, that is to make quicker and faster methods of actually factorizing numbers.
And with the advent of computers, did they have to change the prime numbers as a method of
coding? Well, you can make the prime numbers as big as you like, you see. And now, that's one thing I have to mention as well, that this goes right back to the Greeks. This is in about 230 BC. The great Euclid, who wrote the geometry book, proved that there are infinitely many primes. The primes never stop. They keep going on forever. So any prime you give me this big, I can get a bigger one than that. And that shows you that there's no limit to the size of primes you can
make. Yeah.
And that's comforting, because here's a historical mathematical fact that it can be actually used. Now, one of the other things that I concentrate on a lot, and people like you said, there are lots and lots of unsolved problems in relation to the prime that sound very easy to talk about. You could talk about them in a pub to a fellow for 5 minutes, and he'd know all about what's going on, and yet nobody can do them.
Yeah.
For example, is every even number the sum of two prime numbers?
Right.
For example, 6 is equal to 3 plus 3,
and
10 is equal to 7 plus 3. So every even number that's ever been tested is actually the sum of two prime numbers, and it's suspected that that's true in every case, but nobody's ever managed to prove that.
Right, okay.
Now, in America, the Cole Foundation in the United States has actually offered $1 million for anybody who proves that particular fact. So there's a lot of money to be made if you're clever enough. Of course, the thing may be false. That's the problem, you see. You may be trying to prove something else, but it's very, very likely to be true. I mean, most mathematicians believe it is true. And there are about 10, 12 problems like that I talked about that sound very, very easy to write down, but are extremely difficult to prove, and nobody's ever actually managed to do it. So that's fascinating as well, because every young person ever say, right, I'll have a go at that. And you had the famous Andrew Wiles in England when he was 10 years of age. He heard about this thing called Fermat's Last Theorem. He says, right, I'm going to prove that. And everyone after him. But by the time he was 45, he'd actually proved that. Here was, it's a sort of young and innocent ambition actually turned out to be a world-shattering mathematical result.
Okay. Well, let's hope somebody doesn't do the same thing, or maybe they let's hope they do the same
well,
thing.
Well, I would love to, and I mean, I would love to teach a person. I often say to my students, I say, you're the next young generation of mathematicians. I'm teaching you. I'd love to, someday to read the paper to see that one of my students has actually proved a world-famous result. And some of them have done that already. And that's a great thrill for a teacher to think that you may have steered and guided a student who went on to become world famous.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thanks very much for coming
on.
Just one quick last question. Are you happy about the future of mathematics in Ireland? And, you know, there's a lot of talk that
there's a lot of talk, but I teach that the young people are actually doing mathematics, and I have great confidence in them. I also have great confidence in our teachers. We have some very, very good mathematics teachers in this country, and I know them, and I'm the proud of that myself. I have great confidence in the future, but we mustn't be complacent. We must not let standards drop.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming on. That's Professor of Mathematics at University College Cork, Professor Des McHale, and in case we don't get a chance to talk to you again before you retire, have a nice retirement. Now, that's all we have time for this week, folks. I'd just like to say that anyone that wants to get in touch here with me at the show, and I'd love to get feedback from you, the email is sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie, sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. And also, I'd just like to mention that Science Spin, the magazine, is freely available now. If you just provide your email address, go to sciencespin.com, you can sign up and get it for free. And anyone that's interested in checking out previous episodes of this show, I think there's now 50 plus of those available, and there's a search there, so you can search by topic or by name or whatever. You can go to sciencespin.podomatic.com, or indeed you could go to iTunes if you like and look for Science Spinning under the Natural Sciences heading, I think it is. So thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye for now, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Dublin News for Dublin People, Dublin City FM.
It's 4 o'clock. Good afternoon. I'm Bernard Tweed.